Oscars.
Speak and Destroy is the podcast featuring interviews about Metallica, and I am your host, Ryan J. Downey. My guest this episode is Spirit Adrift frontman Nate Garrett, who is the former guitarist for Gatecreeper and a massive Metallica fan. Three different Spirit Adrift albums have landed in the coveted Top 40 Albums of the Year list in Decibel Magazine, two of them in the Top 10 and one, Enlightened in Eternity, at number 5 for 2020. The album was also included in the Top 10 of the year-end album list from Revolver Magazine. Want to support this podcast? Go into Apple Podcasts, leave a 5-star rating, and write a nice little review like this one from PMC Derm. Bar talk! I can't count how many times at a bar, barbecue, etc. I found myself in a discussion about one of the greatest metal bands of all time, Metallica. This podcast is exactly that. Metalheads talking about Metallica. You will not be disappointed. Or this one from Kelly S. Nunn. Bring on the pain. Love every bit of this podcast. Growing up a Metallica fan, it's great to be able to hear all things about the band with a great host, Ryan. He is the man. Check it out. Thank you, Kelly. Or Blue Earth Jim Dandy, who says, if you like Metallica, this is for you. It's nice to hear a podcast about one thing, Metallica. It is focused, entertaining, and about Metallica. It's awesome. Subscribe. Yes, Blue Earth Jim Dandy. Subscribe to this podcast and the others in the Pop Curse Podcast Network, including Pop Curse, which features musicians talking about movies, and No Prize from God, featuring conversations with creative people about belief, unbelief, and everything between. You can also support Speak and Destroy on Patreon, get access to exclusive bonus episodes called from my interview archives with folks like Glenn Danzig and Kirk Hammett, among others. You can follow me on Twitter at Ryan Downey and on Instagram at Superhero HQ. You can find Speak and Destroy at speakanddestroy.com and on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube. And if you haven't heard Spirit Adrift, what are you waiting for? Go listen to this band. This is my conversation with Nate Garrett of Spirit Adrift. This is Speak and Destroy. So Nate, tell me a little bit about, before we even get to the Metallica part, your earliest experiences with music and, you know, maybe what you heard around the house and at what point you fell in love with it and at what point you realized, okay, not only is this something I love, this is something I need to participate in.
Cool. Yeah, I can definitely do that. You know, I was involved in music from a very, very young age. I was raised by my grandparents, and they put me in piano lessons really young. I mean, like toddler age. But I didn't really, even as a really little kid, I didn't really think it was cool. I had no, like, there wasn't really any profound level of excitement involved in that. But the stuff that I remember hearing super early on that I did take notice of, as far as like exciting me and me thinking it was cool, I remember hearing Creedence Clearwater Revival really early on in life. And then from there, I remember when the movie Happy Gilmore came out, actually, I was pretty young. Yes. I was probably in like second grade or third grade or something like that. The intro has Tuesday's Gone by Lynyrd Skynyrd playing. Yeah. So I heard those guitars and I was like, whoa, that's cool. And I think it took me a while to figure out that it was Lynyrd Skynyrd. And then, you know, this was before it was super easy to just, like, there were no cell phones. Nobody was really using
there was no Shazam. Yeah.
Yeah, nothing like that. Nobody was really using the internet in any sort of useful way. So you just kind of had to randomly hear stuff and hope you could figure out what it was. And the big one was, I mean, I remember Skynyrd, but the big pivotal moment was hearing Jimi Hendrix on an Apple computer commercial, Purple Haze. Mm. And that's when I was like, I have to get a guitar. Fuck piano. Like, piano sucks. I'm going to be a guitar player. Sometime after that, I was watching VH1 and I saw the video for Black Sabbath Paranoid. And that was the moment when I was like, oh, okay, like this is what I'm doing. I looked at those guys and that was like the most definitive sense of direction I had ever felt in my life, was I wanted to look and sound and be like those guys. Mm-hmm. That's kind of what led me to Metallica. And I think Metallica was the next band I really got obsessed with immediately following Black Sabbath.
That's quite a great trajectory, especially with that Skynyrd in there early on. And of course, that was years before Metallica would put Tuesday's Gone on Garage Inc.
Yeah, because I'm only 32. So it was probably only a few years before that, actually.
I guess I'm thinking about Billy Madison in theaters versus.
Right. Yeah. I saw, well, it was Happy Gilmore. So I think.
Or Happy Gilmore. Actually, sorry.
Yeah, yeah. That was even later. So yeah, it's. It probably was a few years later, which when you're in like middle school, that seems like an eternity.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. So I just looked. Happy Gilmore is 96. And I think Garage Inc. was 98 or 99. So yeah.
Okay. Well, wow, man, so
very
I was
close.
I was 8 then when I fell in love with Lynyrd Skynyrd. You said 96?
Yeah, 96.
Yeah.
And then Garage Inc. was November 98.
I was probably more like 13 or 14 when I heard Metallica playing Tuesday's Gone with, I think it's Pepper Keenan and Les Claypool, right?
Yes, and Jerry Cantrell.
Oh my god, crazy.
And John Popper of Blues Traveler.
Nice.
I think it was from one of those bridge school benefits, so there's like a bunch of guests.
Awesome.
Let's talk about then. So Metallica then would have been pretty deep into the Load Reload era. And then, you know, obviously, yeah, Garage Inc. and S&M, the first S&M, is that sort of what they were coasting on when you got into them, or?
Yeah, but again, I didn't really even know how to use the internet at that time. Being raised by my grandparents, it was like this new thing. They didn't really care about it. I was an only child, so I was just kind of like discovering things in these really haphazard kind of ways. And I know I had got a bunch of Black Sabbath CDs from the mall. There was a CD store. I think it was something, and then it became an FYE. But one of the employees in there was this dude, probably in his 20s, maybe early 30s, who the first time I heard Black Sabbath, I went in there that day and I found this guy and I was like, I need some Black Sabbath CDs. And for the rest of like my middle school and high school years, this guy was kind of like a guide for me, you know? So I picked up a bunch of Black Sabbath CDs. You know, I had probably heard 5 or 6 different Black Sabbath CDs. I know Past Lives came out, that double live album, right when I was getting into them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when I figured out who Metallica was, I kind of had a flashback to, I went to this summer camp, I think in between fifth and sixth grade. This camp was in North Carolina. And I remember we went on like a backpacking trip that was like 3 days or something. And we were camping and these rednecks were getting belligerent to the song Fuel from Reload. And I just remember being that age, like out in North Carolina, and hearing this song over and over and over and over and being like, man, that's badass. What is that? So I kind of later, after I discovered Black Sabbath and stuff like that, I realized like, oh, that's that Metallica band. Okay. And I started piecing together like, oh man, they do that song that's on the radio, Sad But True. They do that song too. And they do Nothing Else Matters. And I started figuring out who Metallica was and connecting all these songs. I was like, I can't believe all these badass songs are the same band. So I went to my trusted guy in the music store in the mall in Bartlesville, Oklahoma. And I was like, hey man, I really like Black Sabbath. You know, I've been listening to all this, but I need to start getting into Metallica, I think. And he was like, here's what you need. And he gave me Kill 'Em All.
Wow. What a starting point. Literally, here, yeah. Start at the beginning, kid.
Yeah. And I'm looking at the cover. I'm like, this is fucking rad. And I'm looking at it, but I don't recognize any of the song titles. And so I started looking through whatever CDs they have. And I find the Black Album and I'm like, oh, I know all these songs. So the first two albums that I bought were Kill 'Em All and the Black Album. Which
that is insane and awesome.
Yeah, it's kind of cool looking back because that kind of bookends like my favorite period of the band. Obviously, I think probably everybody's favorite period of the band. But I'll never forget getting home and I listened to the whole Black Album because I knew a lot of those songs. I was super excited to hear the rest of them. I was like, oh, this is cool. Looking at the band photos, they're all wearing black and stuff. This is fucking awesome. These guys look great, sound great, it's heavy. And then I put on Kill 'Em All, and you have to keep in mind the only other metal band I'd heard at the time was Black Sabbath.
Right.
And
I mean that quite the evolutionary leap from the start of metal to the
start of extreme metal. Yeah, I would say yeah. Black Sabbath is kind of like, or maybe Merciful Fate, stuff like that. So I put on Kill 'Em All, and it starts playing. And I didn't dislike it, but I had the distinct thought of, wow, there's been a mistake and the wrong CD wound up in this CD case. This is not the same band. This can't possibly be the same band. Right. And I've listened to the first song, Hit the Lights. I pop it out and I look and I'm like, wow, it's even got the wrong text on it, you know, because the CD itself has Metallica, Kill 'Em All on it. I'm like, this can't possibly be the same band. And I listen to all of Kill 'Em All and I'm like, this is the craziest thing I've ever heard. And then, you know, for whatever reason at that age, I was so ignorant about like how bands work and how releasing albums works and how writing songs works. And I was just completely oblivious to that whole thing. So the idea that a band could start off sounding like that and somehow end up sounding like they did on the Black Album seemed impossible in my mind at the time. So I literally thought it was some kind of mistake.
So great.
But you know, then I got Guitar World magazine and I started reading about like Master Puppets and that magazine really helped clue me in on a lot of stuff. So then I filled in the gaps in between those two albums and obviously it ended up making a lot more sense. But I remember right. that first day I was just like so confused, man. I just couldn't figure it out.
You know, it reminds me when I was a kid, I bought a Black Flag, the Black Flag Jealous Again EP, the 12-inch. And I had an older brother who's 5 years older than me. And I was listening to that 12-inch, like I'd been through it a few times. And my brother came in my room and he said, hey, you know, you're listening to that on the wrong speed, right?
I'd just been
listening to it on the, cause it was a 12-inch. So I had put it at like, you know, album speed, but it's an EP. So it was supposed to be at like 45 speed. So I was listening to like the most doomed out sludgy Black Flag crazy. Anyone's ever heard. And I thought it was awesome. Yeah.
That's kind of what they became though.
Ah, that's a good point.
That's kind of like you, yeah. You were looking into the future.
Yeah. And I was looking into my own future as, you know, as an adult, doom metal is my subgenre of choice. So
nice. Yeah. I have some cool, early memories of those Black Flag albums too. I love that EP particularly.
Me too. And the cover art is just like, I mean, you know, kids throw around the phrase iconic these days, but that was iconic cover art, I think, also.
Yeah, for sure.
So where did it go from there in terms of, you know, learning to play and jamming with other people and the intersection of Metallica and your own career, as it were?
Well, no bullshit. I learned every Metallica song on guitar.
I had a feeling. That's where I was going with it.
Yeah.
From I had Kill a feeling. All
through the Black Album.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's insane.
Every song. You know, I was stuck in this tiny, boring ass, super conservative vanilla town in Oklahoma. And, dude, I had issues even as a kid, which has taken me like this long. I'm 32 now to kind of like identify some of the stuff that was going on. But when I was like, you know, 12, 13, 14, probably even getting into 15, I was like pretty antisocial. I still have some remnants of that sort of like misanthropy and stuff. Social anxiety and stuff like that. But that particular age, I really didn't have a social life at all. So I would sit at home and just learn stuff by ear. I learned a ton of Black Sabbath songs. And, you know, like I said, I subscribed to Guitar World magazine.
Oh, so you were busting out the tabs.
Yeah. You know, I used the tabs, but a lot of the stuff I learned by ear, and I still mm-hmm. play it the way I learned it, which I think probably isn't exactly how they play some of it, but it's what sounds right to me. Guitar World, for whatever reason, was the leading pro Master of Puppets propaganda wing of like journalism.
Ministry of Information.
Yeah, and Master Puppets is great, but I actually have come to believe that Ride the Lightning is probably my favorite Metallica record.
Well, I'll tell you, if and when, you know, when the world resumes some kind of normalcy and touring is happening and whatnot, and you take a deep dive into the episodes of this podcast, you will hear me say that Ride the Lightning is also my favorite Metallica album.
Nice, okay.
Which has cool, changed man. Over the years, but the same thing happened that it sounds like happened with you, where I sort of retroactively settled into that view.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've always loved everything from Kill 'Em All to through the Black Album, and I love parts of Load and Reload too. But
as do I.
Yeah, it's changed so much. I just feel like objectively, in a lot of ways, that's the superior album now. But you know, I remember going on this family trip. And the only two CDs I had with me, it was like a 2-week trip, and I had Vulgar Display of Power and Justice for All. And that's the only, I just listened to them back to back to back to back to back for 2 weeks. So Justice,
you're like, I want everything dry and crisp and pummeling.
Oh man, exactly.
Those two albums. Yeah.
Yeah. All treble and mids and yeah. Clicky kick drum.
Yes.
But yeah, so you know, Black Album was my favorite at first because that's all the stuff I knew. I think at one point Kill 'Em All was probably even my favorite in certain ways. And then it was Master of Puppets because of Guitar World magazine shoving it down my throat. And then probably Justice. And now I think it's Ride the Lightning. And it'll probably change again, I would imagine. But, you know, even before I was in a band, I was just sitting there learning every Metallica song, and I didn't even know why. It just made me happy. It just made me feel accomplished. And I've always had this like really hyper obsessive drive, and to the point of like where it's probably unhealthy, you know. I mean, I was just cooped up in my room, like not talking to anybody, not wanting to do anything. I just actually realized how I first figured out who Metallica was.
Go on.
And it's from, I was in seventh grade, and I just had a memory recall. So the dude that ended up playing bass in the very first band I was in eighth grade we were sitting in seventh grade English, and this dude was like super weird. If I was antisocial, this guy was like living in a cave, you know? And
the weirdos, we always find each other. We always,
oh yeah. Other. Yeah. And we did. His name was Tim. And we were doing seventh grade book reports, but it had to be a biography. And I remember I chose Muhammad Ali. I was like really into him at the time. My best friend growing up was a boxer. And so the teacher like went around the class and was like, who'd you pick for your book report? And people would say, you know, George Washington or whatever. And I was Muhammad Ali. And she got to Tim and he has this book and he holds it up and he goes, Metallica. And there's four guys on the cover. She's like, what are you talking about?
He's
like,
that's the ultimate Hesher move. I love it.
Yeah. And, he was like,
who's your favorite historical figure? Metallica.
Yeah, exactly. Says, I'm doing my book report on Metallica. And she's like, it has to be one person. And he's like, but this book is about all four of them. And she wouldn't let him do it. But I remember seeing their picture on the cover and I was like, man, they look badass. And I found them at lunch. I'm like, okay, that's how I wound up getting Kill 'Em All. Because Tim was like, he's the dude that goes, yeah, if you're going to get anything, get Kill 'Em All because all the other stuff sucks.
Oh, yes. It's so awesome that you met someone like that, too.
Yeah.
That in just, seventh grade. That just seems like an important seminal part of the journey is to know somebody like that.
Totally.
I feel like even Metallica would appreciate that, you know?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Purist.
And the thing about Kill 'Em All that's amazing is if that record existed in some sort of vacuum, right? Like if they never, you know, if the band broke up after they made that, it would still be this really important, cool, special, weird outlier metal album, you know,
100%.
Mind the fact that it was essentially the demo for what the band became.
Yeah.
Because it's really pretty different, you know? I mean, there's obviously a lot of Dave Mustaine on that record, but even still, you know, there's parts of songs that Dave brought in from his old band Panic. There's parts that Hetfield brought in from Leather Charm, you know, and of course there's a bunch of Diamond Head and a bunch of Motorhead influence in there. And it really is, you know, we just think of it as a Metallica album now, obviously, and we know those songs so well, but if you were to, as an adult, discover that band for the first time, I feel like that first album sounds really different and almost sort of disconnected from the rest of them.
Right. That's why I couldn't believe that it was the same band that made the Black Album.
Right.
When I first heard it, I was like, this isn't possible. Between the production and the songs and the vocals and the playing and everything, I was like, this can't possibly be the same band.
Yeah. Whereas if you come in through Reload and then you hear the Black Album, and then if someone handed you Master of Puppets and said, hey, this is their first album, you'd be like, oh, it tracks. You know, that makes sense.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Kill 'Em All. You're just like, who is this weird, like scrappy punk band?
Yeah, totally. Like, and yeah, you know. I just remembered the reason that I got that was not the guy that worked at the CD store. It was my friend Tim who, you know, I secretly also got the Black Album because I wanted that one because I knew all those songs.
Yeah. That makes sense,
but
too.
That was my little secret. You know, I wasn't going to tell Tim that I got the Black Album. I got Kill 'Em All so I could pass the cool test with Tim. And then, filled in the gaps. And then, oddly enough, he and I ended up starting a band with a third guy, our buddy Andrew, who played drums. I played guitar, Tim played bass, Andrew played drums. And that was our very first band. And, you know, one of the very few bands we could all agree on was Metallica. And I think Misfits were probably the other.
Mm, very cool. And my introduction to the Misfits was via Metallica.
Same.
Call. Yeah. So.
Yeah, totally. And I got the coffin like box set.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and that would have been new right around that same time that we're talking about. Cause I think the coffin box was 97.
It had come out, yeah, like during this period for sure, or at least around there.
Yeah, I think it was, maybe 96. You know what? I think it was 96, and then Static Age coming out by itself was 97. But nevertheless, yeah, those are, you know, I mean, I have a Misfits tattoo and I used to sing in a Misfits tribute band with some friends. So,
well, my first band was damn near a Misfits tribute band. I think we learned almost every Danzig era song at some point.
Amazing.
Yeah.
we did it, I think 4 or 5 times. It was always either on Halloween or the Halloween week. And once we opened for a Smiths Morrissey tribute, twice. Amazing. Actually, we opened actually for them twice, but yeah, and it was, I always sang, and then it was different combinations of people from different bands that I'm friends with here in California that would be in it and stuff. But
that's killer, dude. What's really funny is the new, we're calling him our U.S. touring bass player for Spirit Adrift. His name's Sonny. He played in Arizona's best Misfits tribute band.
No way.
Yeah.
That is awesome. That is so awesome, dude. And it's crazy. I mean, it's one of the things I love about a lot of these bands like Metallica and the Misfits that have such a huge cultural footprint is that they can sustain all of these tribute bands and stuff, you know, that can have like careers. I mean, Sweet and Tender Hooligans, which is the Morrissey Smith's tribute band I was talking about, they sell out House of Blues in San Diego, LA, Las
Good
Vegas.
Lord.
And yeah, it's a tribute band. And it's like, and it doesn't, you know, I don't feel like those bands take anything away from the real thing. So it's just great that there's like this little side industry that can exist. I mean, Zach Sabbath, that's a great example also. Like,
true. Yeah.
You know, they play pretty decent sized venues. They're putting out records now. They just put out a record that's them covering the first Sabbath album.
Yeah, we're actually both on a Volume 4 tribute album that just came out.
Oh, well, that's right. I saw that came out, but you know what? I didn't see who all was on it. Which song did you guys do?
We wanted to do Snowblind, but we ended up doing Supernaut, and I'm kind of glad we did because it was like sort of a challenge, and I feel like we fucking nailed it. I feel really good about it.
I'm going to have to listen to that as soon as we're done talking.
Awesome.
That rules. Yeah, my hardcore band I was in 20 years ago, I don't know if you remember when Hydra Head Records was doing their Black Sabbath tribute, but it was like a series of split 7-inches.
Oh, yeah. I got the Neurosis Soylent Green 7-inch.
Yes. I mean, we were trying to get on that. And it's funny in retrospect because we covered, it never came out and we didn't do a very good job of it, but we covered Heaven and Hell. And our idea was, hey, nobody's doing Dio era Sabbath. Because there was this weird moment where in the 90s where, you know, Ozzy came back to Sabbath, and of course everybody worshiped the original lineup as they should. And a lot of hardcore guys, you know, from the hardcore and punk scene and thrash metal guys, like a lot of people were getting into stoner stuff, doom stuff, and of course getting into Sabbath as a result. But it was a weird period where there, at least in the circles I was in, there wasn't really any celebration going on of Dio Sabbath, let alone any other singer other than Ozzy.
Yeah, I feel that. I didn't really get into the Dio stuff until probably like 2007 or so.
Yeah, and I find that interesting because once you're into the Dio stuff, you're like, oh, this stuff is magical.
Amazing. But yeah.
We were the only band who did that, but...
What band are you talking about?
It was a band called Burn It Down. It was not a big band or whatever. We didn't get on there, but it also, Hydra Head had to stop putting out those 7-inches, and they were planning on doing, once they had done however many of them, they would put them all together as an album. But it was around the same time that Sharon Osbourne was doing the Nativity in Black tribute albums. I think they did two of them, and that, you know, those had like Megadeth and Machine Head and, you know, big Ozfesty metal bands. And as I understand it, they put the kibosh on the Hydra Head one.
Bummer. Yeah, I love that split that I have. And what's interesting, that ties in with what you're saying, Soylent Green's approach was great because they did a medley of an Ozzy period song, a Dio period song, and a song from Born Again. But I'm kind of pissed now that they didn't throw a Tony Martin song in there because
might as well.
I'm way into Tony Martin Sabbath these days.
Dude, I love Soylent Green. That was a band actually that my old band played with a few times. They were Ben in particular was like a band buddy to us.
They're mind-boggling, dude.
Mind-boggling, amazing band. And they had Bill Sienkiewicz do one of their album covers. And it's like one of my two or three favorite comic book artists of all time. So lots of love about that band.
Yeah, for sure.
So you have spoken before about that first time you saw Metallica live. What can you tell me about that experience?
Yeah, man, I was 15 and they put out Saint Anger. My friends and I went to Hastings, which was like the new place to get music. And we waited in line and they had like the cardboard cutouts and they did a whole big thing. That's when they were still doing like big day of like album release celebrations, you know? Mm-hmm. And we got it and we the first time I heard the title track, my buddy Lane, the boxer, he had MTV. I didn't have MTV at my house. And apparently they played the music video for Saint Anger on MTV. Lane called me and held his landline telephone up to his TV speakers so I could hear Saint Anger for the first time.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And I remember being like, I had a feeling in my stomach, even as a 15-year-old who's like totally in love with Metallica, even the Load and Reload stuff I've had respect for and love for. I just had this sinking feeling and I was like, are you sure that's Metallica? And he was like, yeah. I'm like, okay. And then, you know, fast forward, we wait in line to get the new album. I think we did a decent job of convincing ourselves that we liked it for a while. And then they were doing one of those summer sanitarium tours. And we were like, dude, even if, however we feel about the new album, like we got to go.
Isn't it interesting, by the way, how you can convince yourself you like something that you really don't?
Yeah. I was talking to somebody about that recently and that mechanism, it wears out eventually.
It does. And I'll tell you, I saw The Phantom Menace 7 times in the theater, paid full price, and yeah,
similar was just thing.
Convinced that I loved it. And of course, now it's like, yeah, so that last section where they fight Darth Maul, that part's cool.
That part is cool, yeah. That part's not bad.
But yeah, you're right. It totally wears off.
Damage Plan is what destroyed mine. I've never been able to do it since then. That Damage Plan record just ruined it. But Saint Anger was a taste of what was to come with the letdowns throughout the rest of my life.
I would never do this to you, but what a great poll quote from this episode. Yeah, no,
you totally can. You totally can. Whatever you want for a poll quote. I'm full of them. So yeah, we got tickets. We're 15 years old. I think Lane might have just turned 16. Or maybe not, because we had my grandparents drove us from Oklahoma to St. Louis. And we went and saw Metallica. And me and Lane were on the floor. We hated every single opening band.
Oh, man, that tour was like, yeah. I don't remember that being a particularly good bill. I don't think I actually saw them on that tour.
It was Mudvayne opening, who was actually by far the best band other than Metallica.
So you already know you're in trouble.
Yeah. And we were 15. We were like, these guys are pretty cool. I remember the singer kind of reminded me of Phil Anselmo. And I was like a huge fan of Pantera. Mm-hmm. At the time, I was like, this is okay. But then Deftones played, not into it. Still not into it. And then Linkin Park played and really not into it, never into it. And then Limp Bizkit played. Ugh. And actually, funny story there, which I do want to tell. When we first got there, security, we ran right up to the front. We're like 15, ready to go. We're going to stand in the front for all 8 hours or however long it takes. Security had these sandwiches wrapped in tinfoil. And there was like shitty peanut butter sandwiches and cheese sandwiches. And they're handing them out to people. And my friend Lane is like destroying fools, trying to like hoard as many of these sandwiches as he can in his t-shirt and in his pockets. He's handing them to me. I'm like, And I'm like, dude, he was just being obnoxious as fuck.
And for the security guards passing those out to the kids, it's like, man, no good deed goes unpunished.
Right. Yeah. And I'm like, dude, what the fuck are you doing? What? We already ate. Like, what's your problem? And he looks at me with this grin on his face and he's got all these sandwiches and he goes, dude, Limp Bizkit's playing later. Like, oh, it makes sense. Okay. So we start like, hey, just getting as many of these things as we can. And we stuff our pockets. We're like running into older, like heshed out Metallica fans and giving them sandwiches. We're kind of like building an army or whatever.
I love and, this so much.
Limp Bizkit starts playing. And we just start, we start tearing off pieces of these sandwiches and crunching them up into these little like tinfoil sandwich balls and just fucking destroying. It was like relentless, just destroying
tinfoil peanut butter and jelly projectiles.
Yeah. And to the point where like Fred Durst keeps stopping the set. He threw homophobic slurs at us, which was kind of his MO.
Luckily he didn't surf out on a piece of plywood and you know, provide a soundtrack to anybody's date rape. He'd save that for Woodstock. Exactly. Yeah,
dude. Well, he would have got, we had like a small army of these like dudes in their 50s and in battle jackets and stuff. And we kept fucking them up and they had to keep stopping the set. And we ran out of sandwiches. I was pulling coins out of my pocket. And I remember hitting the bass player like in his pickups and you could hear it through the PA. He had active pickups, I guess. You could like hear these coins hitting his bass. Fred Durst like was so mad that he started crying, like the cry anger thing, you know, and the bass player had tears in his eyes and they cut the set short. And I swear to God, dude, two shows later, we saw him in St. Louis. I think it was two shows later in Chicago. Limp Bizkit broke up in the middle of that tour and they were gone for years. So you can thank us for that. That's the first time I saw Metallica. Like we broke up Limp Bizkit. And this is before Metallica even plays. We've already broken up Limp Bizkit. It was a great day.
That is a great day. And you know, something I think people may not understand in the context of history is that, you know, there are bands that go on the wrong tours and there are bands that, you know, have a difficult, you know, it's hard to open for Slayer. It's hard to open for Iron Maiden or whatever, you know, and there's bands that challenge an audience because they're doing something new and innovative or strange or obscure.
I'll provide an example, dude. Death Heaven, who are great friends of mine. Mm-hmm. Awesome dudes touring with Anthrax and Lamb of God and Power Trip. That's tough. And
it's tough.
They, you know, they are artists and they're forward thinking musicians and they're good dudes and they're creative. Not the same thing. Not exactly the same thing.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. That's where I'm going with this is that Limp Bizkit's none of that. Limp Bizkit is is getting pieces of sandwiches thrown at them because they're horrific.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to think of the right way to put it because I would hate for Limp Bizkit or any of their supporters to hear a conversation like this one and be like, yeah, Limp Bizkit, dude. It's like, no, they're not iconoclastic. They're not provocateurs. Like,
totally.
There's nothing cool about it. It's because they're, you know what it is? It's because they're intruders. They're like invaders. Like definitely. They're like cultural, like parasites or something. Like,
yeah, and they should have said no to the tour. That's obvious, but
yeah, they should say no to any tour though. Here's the thing: there are a few bands. I mean, I'm generally like, hey, everybody likes what they like. It's all subjective. But my thing is like intention and authenticity. That's all I ask for. I don't have to like the art that results from it, but for me, the measuring stick is, does this person mean it? Do they believe it? Are they doing this because they have to, you know? And I feel that way about, say, Korn, for example. You know, when you would see Jonathan Davis, especially in those early days, you're looking at him and you're like, that guy's got to get something out of him. You know, he's working something out up there. Love it or hate it, like it or leave it. You know, this is real. And then Fred Durst is like, some
about
jock.
The intention thing. Yes. Oh, absolutely.
He's like, he's just some bro that sees Jonathan Davis and is like, that looks cool. I could get girls and money.
Yeah. And I you know, would I do the same thing today? Maybe not, but do I regret doing it? No. Am I glad I did it? Yes. Cause that's what they deserved at that point in time. And I will say, Wes Borland and I have some mutual friends and kind of hang out in some similar circles. Uh-huh. And I hear he's really cool. And he was not in Limp Bizkit when I did that. So he was, I think that guy is probably a pretty genuine artist,
yeah,
but he was not there.
And he does. And I will say, and I have the same sense about him, and I, and just like you, mutual friends and hear great things. And I've actually met him a couple of times. I don't think he'd remember, but then I go, man, but he does keep going back.
That's true. That's true. But he got out before the massacre happened in St. Louis. So
that's true.
That was a smart move.
There's a great, I think it was Dennis Miller. It might've been Colin Quinn. One of the great SNL Weekend Update anchors. I remember doing a joke. It was when the New Kids on the Block were really huge, and he put up a picture of them, and then he started pointing to Donnie Wahlberg, and he was like, this is the one I hate the most, and I'll tell you why. Because he's the guy that, he's the one that's tough. He's dangerous. And he's always got a look on his face like, hey, I might be up here going, whoa, oh, 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 but I'm badass. And I feel like from the artistic cred standpoint, that's kind of Wes Borland.
Yeah, I could see it.
Okay, I'm in the stupid band, but I know it sucks. I'm in on it. I'm cool.
Oh, dude, there's, I would say there's more cases of that in popular metal bands than the alternative. I think most dudes in bands that have been around that long and are that popular are kind of like in on the joke.
They get it. Yeah, I mean, yeah. Hey, I had Mark Tremonti on the podcast. Not, and he was super cool.
He's badass.
It was one of the most popular episodes. Yeah, and you know, and we talked about Merciful Fate and Venom and Death Angel and all. Him in Michigan, me in Indiana. We're similar age. We had very similar experiences getting into music, and it's like, yeah, obviously Creed is a big punchline, but I don't hold it against that guy.
Did he seem to be in on the Creed punchline, or did he?
It's sort of like he understands. And then there's also, you know, I've been trying to get one of the Kroeger brothers from Nickelback on the podcast because there's a thing on YouTube. They're at some like big festival somewhere and they play like half of Sad But True. And it sounds badass. And I'm never going to like Nickelback, but yeah, I don't think those guys are phony. You know, I don't think that they're.
Yeah, I don't think so either, man. And listen, when I was a kid, I'm sure you were in the same boat. If you were listening to Black Flag and stuff, it's like you have a certain view of if people make music that's accessible, that they're phony and they suck, right, and they sold their soul out.
Everyone's the enemy. It's battle lines.
And my view on that has completely changed. And it just boils down to what you just said earlier, which is, is your intention pure? Like, was Nickelback's intention to make really good radio rock music that they actually stand behind and stuff? I don't know. But if so, cool. If not,
yeah,
if
they're literally that's the just sense like, let's I get, just right?
make some money, then fuck yeah. them. You know?
Yeah, I feel like they put off. And look, there can even be art in kind of a winking or a subversive sort of pandering kind of thing, you know, like I can think of some examples where, you know, somebody knows they're kind of pulling one over on the public, and there's a certain
the darkness part
to that.
The yes. darkness. I love that.
A great example.
Their first album is fucking amazing, but they know what they're, I mean, it's like a tongue in cheek thing, but it's also staying true to the spirit of what they're doing.
Yes. And I mean, hey, Typo Negative is one of my favorite bands of all time.
Same.
And yeah, and there's a winking there, of course, and self-deprecation. And if you hear Peter Steele tell it, you know, I don't believe him, by the way, when you see the interviews where he's like, this was all a joke. We're surprised anybody likes it. And it's like, it's, yeah, if you're a super fan like you and me, you know that there's way more going on there.
Right. Well, that's like Toby Hooper saying that he set out to make a comedy when he made Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and he doesn't right. know why people even are scared of it or whatever.
Exactly. Oh, my gosh. Exactly. And by the way, this is what we do on this podcast. Metallica is the anchor, and then we kind of veer off.
It's cool.
And, you know, I'm a huge champion of Lars Ulrich, and he has, I mean, his role in the band just can't be understated in the way, and in culture, and in the way that he is, you know, always curious, always optimistic, always gregarious, always introducing new bands, always paying tribute to older bands. I say all of this is a preface only to say that I think the brief Metallica Limp Bizkit flirtation was all Lars.
Yeah, you're probably right. You're probably right. And I don't fault Lars for that. You know, if you go back and watch Some Kind of Monster, Kirk was the one that was correct in the situation. Mm-hmm. He said, if we do this and this and we don't put solos on our album, then we are dating it to this
right,
period.
To right
and
now, which knew, is, that's like such an amazing, he's like Silent Bob in that movie, right? Doesn't say anything. And then when he does, it's super profound. Like,
yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Like, I mean, you know, Lars had a point, like, oh, that's going to sound dated. That's not like what's going on right now. And then Kirk just had the superior point, which was,
yeah,
no, it's going to sound, it's going to date it to right now.
And he was right.
He was right. He absolutely was. Nobody bats a thousand.
Yeah, true. But I agree with you with the Lars thing. Have you talked to Matt Harvey from Exhumed by chance?
No. And you know what? We have, we've been in contact with one another, and the Exhumed account actually follows the podcast account. Cause I don't know why it hasn't happened yet. Actually. And we've got a bunch of mutual friends.
Dude, we've had many, many Metallica discussions on tour, and he wrote an article for Decibel a while ago about kind of what you just said about people underestimate Lars's and underappreciate the role that Lars plays in the songwriting, the arranging, in the cheerleading of the band, and the ferocious like push to keep the band relevant and to keep the band successful and to keep the band together. The way I look at the Metallica formula is Lars and James are basically equal contributors, just in different ways. I think that's the reality
without
of the situation.
And
not
I don't
a
think,
popular
and I
opinion.
And I don't think James would disagree. No, when you watch their Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction and you see James pick Lars up in the Big Bear Hug and like pick him up off the stage and thanking him for, you know, it that's for somebody who doesn't express those kind of emotions very often, seeing that moment, I always think about that moment because it was true gratitude, and it was really Hetfield acknowledging like, hey, I've got great riffs and cool lyrics and people connect to what I do, but like this is the guy. This guy brought me here.
Yeah.
To the Rock and Roll Hall
of Fame. Here's a caveat, yeah. Not to get too far away from seeing Metallica the first time, but quick caveat on that too. Mustaine and Cliff Burton made Lars and James who they are, who they became.
100%.
Those two guys, like, at this point, Metallica, I think, is like really primarily Lars and James in equal contribution, but to get to the songwriters and creative minds that they ended up becoming, you know, Mustaine and Cliff, I think, were largely responsible. You know, legend is Cliff taught them how to do harmonies, and I think Mustaine kind of showed them how to write like superior riffs in a lot of ways, and just being
and I think
super aggressive.
Mustaine and Hetfield, I think, invented a style of guitar playing.
Absolutely.
And yeah, countless bands. And Mustaine was the first frontman in Metallica.
Yeah,
you know, sure. James didn't really talk, and Mustaine was the attitude, and I think it all worked out. You know, for all the various what if universes, I think it worked out exactly as it should have, because of course we wouldn't have had Megadeth if Mustaine hadn't been out of Metallica. But also there was too much there to contain in one band. Like, we needed all these bands.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, I gotta say, and for Kirk's part, it was really the murder in the, for all my years of Metallica fandom and how much I've always loved Kirk and what he brings to the band, and of course, I mean, you know, he wrote the riff to Enter Sandman, and
dude, he wrote the pre-chorus to Master of Puppets, the Come Crawling Faster part, which is their best riff ever.
Dude, he wrote the Die Die. Yeah. And he wrote that.
That was an Exodus riff, right?
It's an Exodus. It was an Exodus song. Yeah. So that's, it was the Murder in the Front Row documentary where I think Kirk really shines, because that documentary pointed out, as much as we know the lore, the mythology, the story of Metallica coming together, we always hear about Kirk as like, and Kirk was an Exodus and they brought him in at the 11th hour just before they made Kill 'Em All to replace Mustaine. That Murder in the Front Row documentary really gives you a full picture of what a pivotal role Kirk played in the Bay Area. And, you know, he was the leader of Exodus. And when I actually had Gary Holt on the podcast, and he said that Kirk taught him his first chords.
Like, hell yeah.
Taught him how to play guitar, you know? And it's like,
I saw some documentary the other day. It wasn't that one, but it's one that one of the guys from Overkill made.
Oh, yeah. I forget what it's called, but I know what you're talking about. Ex-Overkill guy.
Get Thrashed or something like that.
Yeah, Rat Skates, I think is the guy's name.
Yeah, yeah. And, man, there was some good info in there, too. But I think Gary talked about that in that documentary as well. Talk about a cool guy, man.
Oh, yeah. So it's like if Kirk, you know, Kirk kind of blessed us with Exodus. Even, you know, it's like he planted the seed and then the tree grew all these branches, and it's all kind of branches off the Metallica tree is.
Yeah. Well, look, man, Dave Mustaine sort of kind of gave Slayer a different perspective on how to write riffs. Cause Kerry King was in Megadeth in 84. And then all of a sudden he's writing riffs like Piece by Piece, which are angular and progressive and weird and super complex. And he wasn't writing riffs like that until he started playing with Dave Mustaine. And absolutely, you know, correlation does not always equal causation, but Mustaine will take credit for that shit all day long. So it's a matter of how much do you believe him? You know,
I believe him, you know, because it's, cause it's, and I've said this on the podcast before, but you know, when I was a kid and I was reading liner notes, I understood that Mustaine used to be in Metallica, and I understood that his name was in the writing credits on Kill 'Em All and a little bit on Ride the Lightning. But what I didn't understand, and you don't really understand until you're in bands and know anything about the music business or whatever, is sort of the politics of how, you know, it kind of frustrates me when people talk about the way it's quote unquote supposed to be done with songwriting, because my understanding from a legal standpoint has always been there is no definitive way. It is up to the songwriters themselves to agree or not with each other about, okay, I did all the lyrics and melodies, so that's 50%. Okay, well, I did the riffs, that's 50%. Or, you know, it's up to the individual. So there's no real definitive way. But with that being said, everybody's kind of coming up with how they're going to list that stuff the way they want. And I think maybe because Mustaine wasn't in the band anymore, you know, those songs that he's credited on, he's always credited last. So as a kid reading the liner notes, I thought, okay, so he did like a little bit here. Like, I don't know. I don't know how that worked. And then, you know, fast forward several decades later, and there, you know, Mustaine gets up and plays with them at the anniversary shows. And Lars says, yeah, Dave used to be in this band called Panic. And when he came to Metallica, he brought this song with him called Jump in the Fire.
I knew you were going to say Jump in the Fire.
Yeah. And it's like, it was honestly that moment. And Megadeth's the band that got me into metal. You know, one of my favorite bands of all time, some of my favorite records of all time. My favorite guitar solo of all time is the Holy War solo.
Nice.
But yeah, it wasn't until that moment, 2011 or 12 or whenever that was, that I realized like, oh, this was like a complete song, you know? Like,
yeah. It's taken me this long to really piece together the sheer like magnitude of Dave Mustaine's role, not just in Metallica, but in thrash metal and metal in general. And I think that's because, you know, they touch upon it in the Rust in Peace book that just came out. Mm-hmm. Every move that Metallica made was correct because they had really good management.
Yes.
They weren't that fucked up on drugs and booze and stuff.
And after their first record, there was only one lineup change and it was because of death.
Right. Yeah. And they had a better PR machine. They had a better approach to branding and stuff like that. And Mustaine, being the true fucking aggro criminal, traumatized fucking badass psycho that he is, he never gave a shit about any of that. He was too busy doing drugs and beating the shit out of people and writing music. Like he never put any sort of thought into crafting this sort of PR-based shiny image of himself, you know? And I think it's just now getting to the point where he's sort of putting the effort in to maybe get the credit that he, instead of just like saying some outrageous shit, like, fuck you guys, you know, like he claims that his appearance in Some Kind of Monster was like edited to make him look bad and stuff. Maybe it was, but for sure now he's kind of putting more effort into taking what I think is rightfully his, being the massive amount of credit that is due to him for the writing of Metallica and possibly influencing Kerry King to write different types of riffs in Slayer. And then obviously like Megadeth, that's three of the big four right there that he has a super instrumental role in, you know?
Absolutely. And if you think about, if you look at the big four, to your point about the way the organizations have worked and so on, I remember saying when the big four shows were happening, and looking at the way it was billed, right, where it's like Anthrax plays first, Megadeth plays second, Slayer third, Metallica closes. If you look from the top down, at the time of the big four shows, you had Metallica, who had only changed, you know, the bass position twice, always had the same management pretty much from the jump, you know, from Ride the Lightning on or whatever it was. You know, same record label at that time, like all this consistency. And then you go down to Slayer, and at that time it was the original lineup was doing the big four shows. Same manager for ages and ages, only two different record labels at that time. Then you go down to Megadeth and it's like, okay, now it's only two guys that are consistent. Even one of them was out for a while. And then it's, they've been on a million labels. They've had a million managers. And then you go down to Anthrax and it's like, they've had a million singers. They've had a million labels, a million managers, you know, and not to say, like you said, causation doesn't equal causality, correlation.
Yeah. Does not equal causation or causality,
but there's something there, right? Where it's like, okay, well, from the top down, the way this is built, you have like a descending degree of consistency, both on stage and behind the scenes in terms of just the people, you know? So there's gotta be something to it for not switching coaches in the middle of the, you know, at halftime or whatever.
For sure. Well, I think for Mustaine, it's a case of he is truly like a completely unbridled, like obsessive, manic genius. You know what I mean?
And that goes back to what I was saying about
they're not easy to work with.
Yes, and that goes back to what I was saying about it was too much to contain in one band. You know, that guy needed to be the leader of his own band.
Yeah.
And Lars needed to be the leader of a band. And, you know, a lot of bands, I think, function best with the band boss, where one or two people are, as Gene and Paul like to say, you got two guys in the driver, in the front seat of the car and two guys in the back. And I think, you know, most bands, I think, function best that way, being honest.
Yeah, I agree. I agree totally.
I mean, yeah, when you look at a lot of bands that aggressively try to function as a democracy, it seems like they don't get very far. Or don't get very far for very long. But yeah, I was going to say something else on the Mustaine related band. Oh, I know what it was. This goes to one of your points, bringing us full circle to the top of the conversation. We were talking about the distance of time between Happy Gilmore and Garage Inc. and how when you're of a certain age, that span of time seems super long relative to, you know, when you said you're in your 30s now it's like, it starts flying by. Oftentimes, one of the things said to kind of discredit Mustaine's, impact and influence within Metallica is that, well, he was barely in the band. He was in the band for this short amount of time. But in those formative years of a band, especially a band that's so important, that short amount of time is a lot.
Yeah, you know? I would say like a month is worth like a year in that.
Yeah.
In that measurement of time, for sure.
You could argue that, I mean, certainly, and this is no disrespect because I love Jason Newsted, and listeners of this podcast know that he's actually my favorite Metallica bassist, and I love all of them. But you could certainly make the argument that Dave Mustaine had more of an impact on Metallica in that extremely short amount of time before the first album's even recorded than Newsted had in over a decade of service.
100%. And I love Jason too. I love everything about him. I love his personality and his
personality, his integrity, humility, stage presence.
Yeah, everything.
Dude, the backing vocals. The number one thing that I miss, no disrespect to Kirk or Rob, but those Newsted backing vocals were just
amazing. Perfect match.
And they became such, it was like a Michael Anthony in Van Halen for me. Like, it became such a part of my life.
And it, dude, if you go, I just recently listened to his tryouts where the bass is cranked up pretty high, and it is insane. His playing was like perfect for that band. Just incredible bass playing.
The aggression, the attack, everything about his approach.
Yeah.
So great. And that whole idea of, you know, first one in the venue, last one to leave, you know, that work ethic. I feel like growing up a Metallica fan, I learned a lot from the Jason Newsted work ethic.
Oh, totally. Dude, he's a kid that like hit it big and he never changed. He never turned into it. He never lost that like childlike enthusiasm and pure intention and humility, which is incredible, you know?
It's so awesome. Well, dude, I would love to have you back sometime because we could obviously, as you said, talk about for hours and hours.
Yeah, whenever, dude.
And this is what we do. This is exactly how these episodes roll. You know what?
Let me say real quick, looping back to the first time
I saw him. That's what I was just about to say. You know what? We didn't even talk about actually.
No, if anybody wants the end of the story, they can go watch the Revolver, What's the Best Metallica Song, because I tell it on there and it changed my life.
It was a life-changing experience for sure. And it was also a life-changing experience for Fred Durst. So bravo.
he learned a few lessons that day, I think.
It's funny because I've so outgrown the us versus them of any kind of battle lines in music. But that's a particular band that for some reason, and not even the band as much as the specific dude that really, ugh. Story for another time, but I had a personal interaction with Fred Durst and with the drummer of the band, John Otto, that was quite unsavory. So,
oh wow. Well, really, I'm glad we fucked them up and broke that stupid band up for a while.
That band and Kid Rock, that's the other one where I'm just like, no thanks.
Yeah.
But other than that, I celebrate everyone who's been connected to Metallica.
Yeah, I try to. I try to celebrate everyone. But, you know, dude, we were 15 and we didn't fuck around. If we didn't like something, we went after it, you know?
Well, I've told this story on the podcast before, but I'll leave you with this. My first time seeing Metallica was Monsters of Rock in 88, which was Van Halen with Sammy Hagar, Scorpions, Dokken, Metallica, and Kingdom Come.
Oh, my God.
And my friend and I went in our Metallica shirts. We stood with our middle fingers in the air during all of Kingdom Come. We watched Metallica and then we went home.
Amazing.
If I had it to do over again, I would love to see Van Hagar. I would love to see the Scorpions. But at the time it was just like, yeah, every other band playing today is some hair metal poser stuff.
Well, when your fans are that way, you know that you've created something special.
Indeed. Indeed. Well, thanks so much, man. This has been super awesome. Don't be a stranger. Let me know if there's ever any way I can help you with anything, and I'll let you know when this goes up. I've actually for once have a bunch in the bank, so
awesome, might be a minute. Man, thank you.
Just confirmed Dave Lombardo for the podcast this morning.
Oh, you're shitting me. Wow.
I'm looking forward to that.
That's amazing. Dude, I don't know if it could possibly come up, but the day before I recorded the very first Spirit Adrift full length, this is when I was still playing drums.
Mm-hmm.
I went to see Dave Lombardo do a drum clinic in Phoenix, and it was fucking awesome. It lasted like an hour. This was 2015.
Okay, and wow.
I brought a pair of drumsticks that I was going to use to track the Spirit Adrift album. And when the signing was over, I walked up to him, and, you know, he's Cuban. So I was like, hey, man, do you think you could put some
some vibes on these, or like some Santeria shit or something. And I was like, I'm using these to record an album starting tomorrow. And he looks at me, he kind of thinks, and he's like drenched in sweat. And then he takes the drumsticks, he rubs a drumstick under each armpit and gets them soaked with sweat, gives them back to me. I'm like fucking elated by this. And I use the drumsticks to record the drums for the first Spirit of Drift album, Chained to Oblivion. And they broke at the end of the last take of the last song. They both fucking exploded.
Are you kidding me? Of course I'm telling him this story.
I swear to God.
True story. Of course I'm telling him this story.
Please, dude.
Especially because it's important for guys like that to remember that those little, something that's just a little, you know, 30-second moment for them is like a life-changing moment for somebody else.
Yeah,
you know?
Please just pass on to him that I appreciate that so much and I love him, and he's an inspiration.
That rules the world. I love it. Killer, man. Yeah, keep in touch. I appreciate it.
Thanks, brother. I had a lot of fun.
Me too.